Hello and welcome to the DebtWire podcast. I'm your host, Vandalina Jakob, co-managing editor of DebtWire North America. I am glad to be joined today by James Spade, managing director and partner at Clearlake Capital and head of Clearlake Credit. James, welcome to the show.
Madalena, thank you very much for having me.
James, before we dive into strategy and credit markets, I'd love to start with your journey. You've had a pretty unique career path, from professional tennis player on the ATP tour to Google, Credit Suisse, and now partner and managing director at Clearlake, who is leading Clearlake's credit. Can you walk us through how that path unfolded and what ultimately drew you into the world of credit and investing?
It's been quite the journey. I never thought I'd be sitting in this seat today. I've always had a really strong desire to be able to get into business more broadly. I've always loved businesses, trying to figure out how they work, how we make them better, what makes a good business versus a lower quality business. It's been a fascinating journey to be able to get here, and I've been lucky enough to be at Clearlake now for the last 13 years. To go back to the beginning, I left school to try to play professional tennis and probably got one of my first lessons in professional life that there's a lot of really good people out there in the world trying to be successful, and ultimately didn't make it. I had surgery a couple times, went back and finished my last year at school, and then went on to get a real job.
You had a backup plan.
I was able to land on my feet at Google, which was a fantastic experience, actually quite relevant today. We worked on some projects in and around Google building their first own data center. It was an amazing project to be able to be a part of. But ultimately, I wanted to really understand how businesses worked at the highest level of a business. Google was still a very big business at this time and ended up making the jump into investment banking and then ultimately into private equity and credit after that.
Very interesting journey. Let's now go back to Clearlake, your last stop. Clearlake has recently acquired MV Credit, White Star, and consolidated them with its existing credit platform under one roof, Clearlake Credit. Are there new opportunities you're pursuing now that weren't as accessible before? I'm talking whether it's geographically or structurally or in terms of scale. Basically, what are your priorities for the business?
Our priorities for Clearlake Credit are very much the same as what we had before, but now we're trying to do it under one roof in a coordinated and integrated fashion. We always had a credit business in the U.S. that was both a private credit and a liquid credit business that came out of heritage of Clearlake. We've always been a hybrid firm in the sense that we did credit out of our funds here at Clearlake, as well as private equity. With the acquisition of White Star in 2000, we moved into the liquid credit in the broadly syndicated loan market. We still very much want to grow that platform. We just feel today was a really good time to be able to integrate it because sponsors and borrowers out there are looking for more than just a singular solution. They're looking for someone who can be a solution provider to them, can play across multiple parts of the capital structure, and we want to do that with a singular touch point so we can have coverage of each of those sponsors. So hasn't necessarily changed our strategy in terms of what we're doing day to day, but it's made it a lot easier to be able to grow, to be able to build the top of the funnel in terms of sourcing incremental opportunities and continuing to do what our clients want us to do. And that's to try to be creative and be able to show up when we say that we're going to show up. It's early days where we've only been going at this, at least as an integrated group, for the last 4 or 5 months, but we've really been able to feel the momentum and feel the cultural shift of things coming together.
And Clearlake now splits, as you mentioned, its credit strategy into two main buckets, right? Liquid and private. Let's start with liquid credit, broadly syndicated loans, CLOs, and distressed credit. Out of these areas, where are you seeing the most compelling opportunities right now, and what's driving that?
We define our liquid credit business as being three different parts. There's the broadly syndicated loan business that we're active in via our CLOs. Our shelf name is called Trinitas. We also have a structured credit business. We're out sourcing, purchasing double Bs and even single Bs in CLO liability world. Then we have our opportunistic credit business, which we're out, whether it's sourcing on a proprietary basis, doing more directly originated and direct lending, as well as going out and being able to buy into good credits that are mispriced. We do that across both the US and Europe today, and that encompasses liquid credit. Liquid credits, it's a hard business right now. We are starting to see some of the tightest spreads that we've seen in a long time in particularly the first lien leveraged loan market. There was a B3 transaction that priced at 225 over the last couple of weeks. And it's pretty amazing to be able to see that. It's very much a market of the haves and the have-nots, the haves being really high quality companies. And they've been able to get spreads and pricing that is about as tight as it's ever been. And then the have-nots are having a really hard time at least accessing the liquid credit market and are having to rely on mostly the private credit market in order to find financing. It's not easy out there if you're a CLO manager or you're someone looking for opportunistic credit situations just because there isn't a plethora of opportunity. But as we know, the market can change very quickly and the CLO math generally still works where the liabilities are attractive enough where they can support transactions and supports financings at spreads that are quite tight. But we'll see what happens. I think there's still some general weakness in the overall economy, and the levered loan market is really seeing a technical bit at the moment where there's just not that much new issue moving into the market. So we're trying to be thoughtful about putting out capital. We also want to have a really high quality loan book and be able to have companies in that loan book that no matter what the economy does, we feel very good about owning those credits.
That sounds very interesting because you basically talk about distressed credits and special situations, and especially in today's environment of high rates and uneven growth, are there particular sectors or deal types where you're seeing more dislocation or urgency? Where is Clearlake leaning in and where are you more cautious?
We take a sector-focused approach, even though we run a diversified portfolio within our broadly syndicated loan book. We bias to things that will have heavy recurring revenue, bias heavily towards tech, healthcare, things that can be consumable products on the industrial side, as well as infrastructure. Those are some really strong sectors for us. Right now, you're not seeing any real significant weakness in a lot of those sectors. Clearly, the industrial landscape, you're seeing weakness in the buildings products space, but I think not as much as people thought. Tech still hanging in there and is strong, and AI is the topic that everyone wants to talk about it because it will impact software more than software has been impacted in a long time, but we still remain bullish on the sector. The spaces that we're playing in, we haven't seen a substantial amount of weakness in. It's continued to be smooth sailing, at least right now, but as you go talk to CEOs or CFOs out there, things are not easy in running businesses today. There's big transformations happening with AI, in terms of the cost opportunity, but also the product enhancement opportunity. It's something that we're keeping an eye on, and potentially we'll see some movement over the course of the next couple of years on who's done it well and who potentially has lagged behind some of those trends.
And James, you talked about the private credit side a few minutes ago. Clearlake has deployed over $17 billion across more than 225 companies globally. That's a significant footprint. Where are you seeing the most attractive opportunities in private credit?
One of the reasons why we rebranded to Clearlake Credit is most people didn't know that we were as active as we were in private credit. And maybe to backtrack, just to give the listeners a sense of what we do, we think about our private credit business being regular way unitranches and senior direct lending, as well as junior credit opportunities, both in the US and Europe. And we will put our equity hats on at certain times, and we're happy to do more structured equity that has some equity upside, but is going to be structured a bit more debt to be able to minimize cost of capital for borrowers and sponsors. We're seeing a tremendous amount of opportunity in private credit, particularly given flexibility that you're seeing within private credit today. Ratings are making it harder to borrow in the broadly syndicated market, and cash flow, which is the key component of how we all underwrite deals, but that's not easy right now with where rates are. If you can go refinance in the broadly syndicated market and get spreads that are at very close to historical lows, that's really attractive. But if you can't, it's highly likely that you're going to struggle a bit with interest burden given where rates are today versus where maybe you originally bought the business and financed it. We're seeing a lot of opportunities to be able to get into what we view as stable quality companies, but potentially haven't been able to access the broadly syndicated market in such a way, or they have a ratings issue, or they potentially have a quantum of leverage, which might be too high, but we know and build a thesis around the fact that they have plenty of equity cushion beyond that. And the sponsor is going to be able to support that business. And it is a high quality business, but maybe doesn't have the most efficient capital structure today. So we're seeing that flexibility in both the US and Europe be required in private credit. And that's what we like. We're happy to go in, be a solution provider to sponsors and be a partner to them and try to set up a structure that can work for the company, be attractive for both us, but also a win-win for the sponsor. So that's what we're seeing. We're spending a lot of time within tech, a lot of time within healthcare. In the infrastructure side, I think have been very interesting as well, but we'll continue to take a sector-focused approach to it because we have a strong view that you need to know these businesses really well to be able to underwrite the risk, particularly given how quickly the overall economy and innovation is occurring in the market, particularly with AI. You have to be able to know these businesses, have a view on what's going to happen to them over the course of the next couple of years. And private credit, while we don't have equity upside in a lot of those cases, we still need to get that right. We want to be able to work with companies that we feel like are well-positioned over the next few years and then get the right capital structure set up for them.
You talked about the spread being close to historical lows in the broadly syndicated market. Have you seen spreads widen recently in private credit? And if so, by how much? I'm curious, if that happened, how is that impacting the way you're pricing risk or competing for deals?
The private credit market is competitive and there's more and more attractive cost of capital. And the private credit world on a levered basis, if you can make mid-teens, that's an incredibly attractive asset class for a lot of institutional investors. Even if you're doing that on an unlevered basis to make in the high single digits, you have to be able to minimize loss rates as much as possible. And so that's one of the things that we're focused on. From a rate perspective, I think that the best credits out there within private credit are getting priced in the mid to high fours spread. At the same time, you know, most deals are kind of somewhere in the fives, and you need to be able to match up that situation. I think for us, we try not to stretch for yield. We try really hard to be able to have a view that it's a high quality business that we're going into, able to give them an appropriate cost of capital. And ultimately, if that means the company does really well and we get refinanced out by the broadly syndicated market, that's a good thing. That means that we've picked the right credit. The company's done what they said they're going to done. But we also, at the same time, we would love to have businesses that remain in the private credit market. As people have seen, there's that constant tension of the private credit market trying to be competitive with the broadly syndicated market, and the broadly syndicated market, just like it is right now, saying, hey, I can make the math work and I'm going to go effectively underprice the private credit market, but I'm only going to do that with names that I've known for a really long time or really high quality. There's always going to be a bit of that tension.
You keep saying you don't really have an equity upside when it comes to private credit, but we've seen a lot of private credit lenders taking the keys from sponsors. It's not obviously as prevalent as in the BSL market, but that's happened recently with some names and loans being marked under par. You really want to be taken out with the loan from the BSL market, or the company can refinance with other lenders.
Our goal absolutely is to get refinanced out or get taken out or have them sell the company. We're not looking to take the keys. I do think the private credit market has a big advantage in that sense for a few reasons. One, typically there's going to be a much smaller group of lenders that's going to be negotiating with the sponsor. And a lot of times that's going to be a relationship conversation. The private credit firm can have flexibility to try to give the sponsor incremental time to be able to hopefully get the situation right. In the broadly syndicated market, you're dealing with 30, 50, 100 plus lenders that you have to get on board to be able to get something done. And that makes it really hard. And so in a lot of those cases, the CLOs will sell out, particularly if loans are below 80, and start getting the opportunistic funds in those situations. And they'd be more willing to drive a harder bargain in those circumstances, which they have every right to. In the private credit market, one, the negotiating dynamic is a little bit different. Two, the private credit situation has a bit more flexibility in their structure. If you need to pick interest for some period of time, if you need to waive a covenant, it's not necessarily going to impact your ratings or your bucket capacity, particularly if you're running unlevered. The third piece within private credit, this really makes a big difference, is you're a repeat user of the product if you're a sponsor. And we do the same thing with our private equity business. We work very closely with private credit. Not every business is always smooth sailing, but you know that you're going to go sit down, you're going to have a partner that is going to try to work with you and try to find a solution. It means treating those relationships on the whole, on the aggregate. And I think that makes a really big difference that historically in the CLO world is evolving, and that is getting a bit more relationship oriented than it used to be. But the private credit market historically has had a big advantage, even though a lot of the businesses that private credit is financing, you could argue could be a little bit riskier in the sense that they're smaller. There's maybe a reason they haven't been able to access the broadly syndicated market, but you're going to have tighter documentation generally and that relationship dynamic, and have a better seat at the table if things don't go the way that everyone hoped.
Let's shift gears a little bit now. I want to talk a little bit about the MV credit acquisition, because with this acquisition, Clear Lake's reach into Europe has grown. So what are some of the key differences you're seeing between the US and European markets in terms of competition and investors' demand?
What we really liked about the MV credit acquisition was the culture of the team, just really strong credit culture that was very similar to the credit culture that we had at Clear Lake. And the products that they had were very similar to the products that we have in the US. They're doing senior direct lending in Europe and subordinated debt and junior credit type opportunities in Europe. What we see is Europe is a little bit more of an inefficient market than the US. It's a little bit less competitive. It's a market that typically would have slightly better covenant packages and documentation. It also depends a little bit where base rates are, but historically it's had a little bit more yield associated with it. What we really liked about it was the credit culture and being able to scale the platform. MV, given their prior ownership, was a very small piece of a much, much larger business. They were owned by Natixis. What we wanted to be able to do is come in and to provide some support for them from a distribution perspective and a scale perspective, because we think that the European market will continue to be repeat users of private credit. The other thing we're seeing is you have a lot of US firms that are looking to expand in Europe, European firms that are looking to expand in the US. You're seeing a lot more of connectivity, a lot more of that need across both US and Europe from a singular source. We've done a couple financings on the private credit side recently, where it was a big advantage to be able to play in both the Euro tranche as well as the USD tranche for sponsors. And we're seeing that occur more often. The last piece that we didn't necessarily expect this dynamic, but given what's going on geopolitical and from a currencies perspective at the moment, we're seeing more people, particularly in the US, think about the need to diversify and have a bit more European exposure.
You're talking about tariffs and everything, all the turmoil?
Absolutely. And it's not necessarily that we view the US being a different market than it was yesterday. We still believe very strongly in the US market, and institutional investors and LPs got very concentrated in the US, just given the growth over the last 10 plus years, and need to take a step back and think about their diversification. Currencies have moved substantially. Tariffs have impacted things. It sounds like we've made some progress with the EU, which is good. But at the same time, diversification is a critical component to any investor's key investment decisions. If you're a public pension fund in the US and you're thinking about your strategy, you absolutely need to think about how you're diversified, not only across credit and equities, but also from a currencies and a geographic exposure.
Yes, definitely. Now, if we shift a little bit gears and we look at the way you underwrite the deals, you've deployed nearly $70 billion, correcting me if I'm wrong, across Clear Credit, with the ability to underwrite up to $1 billion per deal. But what really stands out, I think you emphasized earlier, the flexible capital solutions. But what does that mean in practice? Can you maybe share an example where that flexibility really made a difference for a borrower?
I won't use any specific names, because we want to respect the sponsors that we do business with, but I can give a little bit of an example of what we're seeing. We may be holders, or we're coming into a situation, very high quality business. We have a number of situations where the first lien is a really good first lien solution. You might have a unitranche in that case, but from a cash interest perspective, it's starting to get tighter. Maybe when they bought the business, interest coverage before rates went up was at 2 to 3 times interest coverage. That today is probably closer to 1 to 1.3, 1.4. A lot of sponsors out there are looking for solutions that are going to give them some flexibility from a PIK perspective, so PIK interest, or something more junior in the capital structure to be able to provide incremental liquidity. In those situations, we do have the ability to have flexibility, and you have to be very mindful of it because you're not getting paid. It now comes down to, and I think a lot of folks in private credit will think this way as well, there's just such a big focus on how are you underwriting to LTV or loan to value. Going into those situations, wanting to feel like there's plenty of equity cushion that sits junior to the securities that we have, whether it's subordinated debt or whether it's just a senior first lien facility. As long as we feel comfortable that there is substantial equity cushion junior to that, we will have some PIK flexibility because a lot of these companies at this time need it. And if you want to be able to go invest in the business and make the business better, you're not going to do that by just cutting costs and paying cash interest and just surviving. That will only go on so long. We want to be able to give the company the right opportunity to continue growing as they are. I think more and more lenders are looking at it on an LTV basis more than they have before. We still have to be very mindful that cash interest is cash interest for a reason. We need to make sure we're getting that underwrite absolutely correct.
And what is your LTV percentage? You know, the normal rate, or when you look at LTV, do you feel more comfortable?
The biggest thing that we look at in a lot of situations is we want to come up with our own view of LTV. It may be you're quoted an LTV amount that's what the sponsor paid, but it may be the case that the sponsor paid a lot more than everybody else in order to do that. Or it may be that the sponsors create a lot of value over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, and an LTV is actually a lot better than actual the cash LTV that you may be implied from how much cash the sponsors put in at the time. We always really try to put our own thinking into it and have our own view, rather than just relying on here's what one person paid for this asset without having a sense of really where the market was. And in those situations, it's going to depend on whether we're senior in the capital structure or junior in the capital structure. But we do want to see healthy cushion. Every situation is a bit different. There's not a firm rule that says, you know, everything needs to be at 50% LTV. But we very much look at each situation and just want to make sure that our securities in it are going to be protected.
You've talked about liquidity runway. Clearlake has been involved mostly from the sponsor side in several high-profile LMEs, liability management exercises. Some of them are more aggressive in terms of structure or lender concessions. In your view, what makes a well-executed LME? How do you see their role in truly extending runway versus just delaying the inevitable, an in-court restructuring?
LMEs are challenging. We've found ourselves in a world where underlying lenders and the underlying documentation, particularly in the broadly syndicated market, are really loose. And when companies, whether they're in our portfolio or in other people's portfolio, they're not doing as well as the sponsor hoped, it's very much our job as the sponsor, or anybody's job as the sponsor, to be able to go do what they can to make a return on equity for our institutional LPs. Most of the time, what we're seeing with LMEs is if there's a liquidity need or if there's a maturity extension need, an LME is largely being used as something, as a tool to be able to get those. In certain circumstances, there may be discount involved to be able to try to right-size the balance sheet. LMEs have gotten a bad name generally, largely because the first transactions, at least in this more recent wave, were companies that really needed it and they were struggling. And now you're seeing it be a bit more prevalent. And I think that's dangerous for lenders. I also think that for large lenders, particularly ones that have a strong relationship with the sponsor and are going to be doing things very much on a relationship basis with the sponsor, I actually think these LMEs are not that challenging. If you own a very small portion and don't have a relationship with the sponsor or the company, it's hard. It's very hard in today's market to be a very small CLO manager.
And you're saying it's very hard to be a small CLO manager just because we've seen these multi-tier LMEs, right?
Even in the ones where you haven't seen the multi-tier, I think you just go along for the ride and you're up to the judgment of the bigger folk that are in the structure, even if you're part of a co-op. Even with co-ops, it still gives a big advantage to the scale players, because they're ultimately the ones driving the decision. And they may even be the ones who actually proposed the LME to begin with. They might actually get a market gain in those circumstances. They're able to really protect their position. They're able to tighten documentation substantially. And even in things that are fully done pro rata, you're along for the ride.
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, it's always been like that, right? The big players were driving in-court restructuring, spending months negotiating restructuring support agreements, and then implementing them in bankruptcy.
I think it's very fair, but I don't think anybody's goal in any of these situations was to have it end in a bankruptcy filing. Both the lenders and sponsors are looking to try to do everything they can to get more liquidity, more runway, and make sure the lender is clearly trying to protect themselves, that if things go bad, that they're going to be in the driver's seat, and the sponsors trying to get more runway, more liquidity, more flexibility, so that they can live another day and get the company in a better place. But it's also why we have the bankruptcy system here in the US. And it is a very efficient system in a lot of cases. In those cases, I think the worst case scenario is that you have a free fall bankruptcy and something comes out of nowhere and you end up in bankruptcy for a really long time. But the good news for a lot of these lenders is if they did an LME before, it's highly likely going to be a fairly efficient bankruptcy process. But in 99.9% of cases, no one's really looking to get it there, but they have been smart in order to be able to protect their downside. And that's what you've seen a lot of the larger lenders push for.
And they are typing documents, of course.
Of course.
Through the process.
Yeah, that's the trade.
This is a bit of a sensitive question, but there's been some chatter in the market about Clearly going on an apology tour with lenders. And I wanted you to clarify how the firm has approached lender communications and how do you factor in reputation in the context of these complex liability management exercises?
I'm happy to give a little bit of perspective and maybe insight into some of these conversations because I was the one doing them.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
The only thing I disagree with is that we didn't apologize. We are fiduciaries to our LPs and investors, and we are going to do everything we can to be able to protect our equity while also having an open dialogue. The biggest goal out of the conversations was to open up the communication channel with people that we haven't had good communication with. We've been really strong with our relationships in the private credit world, but in the broadly syndicated market, it was typically a market that your relationships was a bank syndication desk, and you didn't have a lot of direct interaction with a lot of the CLOs, or maybe have a little bit more interaction with some of the opportunistic credit firms because they're proactive in reaching out, but less with the CLOs. And we want to change that. And not every CLO manager is going to be happy with us to do that. We understand that. We're happy to take their feedback as well. But we also want to be rational about how ClearLake sits in those situations. And we wanted them to understand our perspective and why we're here. And no situation is the same. But we do want to at least have that communication, have that level of dialogue, and we wanted that to be able to change. Does it change our strategy around what we're doing more broadly at the firm? Not necessarily, but we're also practical that we want to be able to, going forward, get the documentation right on things. You look at the most recent large financing we did, which was done in Bradstreet. It was a $5.5 billion financing with a mix of private credit and broadly syndicated investors. It's a rated facility. And we went out and were very proactive around LME protections within that document, very proactive on the collateral package within that document. You'll see that will continue from our side. We viewed the transactions that have occurred already as things that either needed to happen or things that we needed to be able to go into those situations. And if we were going to tighten the document, we needed to be able to approach it in a way that it wasn't just a one-sided conversation. For us, it was all about communication and dialogue and not necessarily about apologies. We had a lot of really positive, rational conversations, and we hoped that those would continue.
Thank you so much for offering this answer. Let's talk about structure and documentation, because you did mention how important documentation was in your latest deal. That was, by the way, congrats. That was a great deal. I think it's one of the largest private credit deals.
It was one of the largest buyout private credit deals. I'm not a big congratulations person until we sell businesses and make money for our LPs, but we were really proud to be able to get it done. We were really happy given all the support that we got from the lending community, and we're really excited about the deal overall.
I don't know if you can answer this, but just tell us one protection that you really care about, one that has to be in there, otherwise there's no deal.
There wouldn't be any specific term that I would point to, but as I said earlier, we will be very proactive. Any LME sensitivity that lenders had, we're going to be able to get them comfortable with that. And we're going to do that from a documentation perspective.
And finally, James, I wanted to ask you a question about co-ops, since you mentioned them earlier. They've become a central issue in LME documentation. What role do you think these co-op provisions play in shaping lenders' dynamic? Are they helpful guardrails for alignment, or have they become like a structural obstacle to getting deals done?
I think it's been both. I think in situations where a co-op has been a substantial part of the capital structure, they have enabled transactions to get done. But there's also been a number of situations where a co-op has prevented it from getting done because there's been some lenders in there who just disagreed with the larger lenders, and the co-op gives them a lot of power to be able to do that. It's very situational. In certain circumstances, if you have a very strong majority within the co-op, that can be a powerful tool to get something done. But in other situations where it can be really broad and don't necessarily have like-minded people within the co-op, because within the co-op, you may have some opportunistic credit funds. You may have some par holders who are CLOs or even direct lenders. They're going to have a different approach, and that can make it challenging when they all need to agree via the co-op. In general, I think it comes down to ultimately lender-on-lender violence. The market, it doesn't like it for good reason, and co-ops are trying to be used as a tool to prevent that. But we as a firm, more on the credit side, tend to be a bit skeptical We want to make sure we understand who's driving the co-op. We want to understand, make sure that we understand their incentives, what their goals are. And then just back to the relationship point, it comes a lot more down to having a direct dialogue, because these calls are hard and they're very driven by some really good lawyers out there. But getting everyone to align within a big group can be tough.
James, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks for taking the time to share your valuable insights.
Thanks again for having me. It's fun to be able to talk about it, and I appreciate you doing it.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of That Wired. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode on Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at thatwired.com.